Now on BBC Radio 4, from this moment on, the series in which Nigel Wrench of the PM programme takes a defining incident in modern history and examines its impact on what followed. In February 1961, Bertrand Russell sat down outside the Ministry of Defence in Whitehall in protest against nuclear weapons. It began a tradition of civil disobedience and of celebrity involvement in political campaigning. From this moment on, when the philosopher sat down.
Without knowing it, knowing how to name it, I have this dread of something awful about to happen. It's not a fear of the bomb, I don't think it's that, but of some kind of anarchy with all the accepted and expected patterns of behaviour between people breaking down.
Arnold Wesker, the playwright, is 70 now. He reads a short story about the threat of nuclear war with an intensity that reveals why, more than 40 years ago, he became a dedicated peace campaigner.
I feel not that justice is about to be claimed by the disinherited, but that old scores are going to be paid off. There are mad angers about, and I want to lay low until they're spent and protect my children.
Wesker is famous as one of those whose work redefined the British stage. But there's something else. Along with other big names, like Vanessa Redgrave, Henry Moore, John Osborne and Benjamin Britten, Arnold Wesker agreed to break the law in the cause of fighting the fear he describes in his short story, The Fear of Nuclear War. He signed up to a group called the Committee of 100. In its few years of existence, this committee would redefine political protest. It was a time when Arnold Wesker was one of the angry young men of the theatre.
I never considered myself angry. I mean, no angrier than Winston Churchill or Jesus Christ or Nietzsche or anyone who felt strongly about anything. But the facts of life are that when you have a degree of fame, you have a degree of influence, and people do listen to you because you have made sense, a kind of sense, in your writings. Why shouldn't you make sense in what it is you're campaigning for or protesting about or having an opinion about? And if people are getting to listen to you, then I think you have a responsibility to use your name for a while.
There was already a spirited movement against the bomb. The long, singing protest march was the order of the day. To Aldermaston and the nuclear weapons establishment one year, back with thousands of people added, to Trafalgar Square the next. The marchers held the new peace sign aloft, symbol of the fledgling Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND. You walked for as long as you wanted. Michael Randall was a young activist who made this his life.
I'd been on these demonstrations going back to the 50s when a few hundred people or a few thousand people was the most, and suddenly the square was nearly full.
Coming down from Aldermaston, marching to Trafalgar Square, I saw 30,000 people.
John Profumo, are you there?
Coming down from Aldermaston, marching to Trafalgar Square.
Aldermaston was a breakthrough because of the size of the demonstration. The London Co-op said they would lay on catering. And then we got musicians coming in, jazz musicians, folk musicians, all things that we were coming on this march. So it took off in a huge scale. These marchers, they were prepared to go through the hardship of walking from London to Aldermaston through some of the worst weather in 40 years.
This is bomb number 6, a new atomic weapon, not an improvement of an old design.
But the weapons were becoming more powerful. The newsreels suggested they were a guarantee of peace. For the protesters, they underlined the certainty of war. Perhaps singing wasn't enough.
Here is power. Power men have dreamed of for centuries. Power to destroy, power to create. Who will use it and how? Man has realized his dream. He must control it.
In London, a radical American student called Ralph Schoenman was making ban-the-bomb speeches on Hyde Park Corner. There was no doubt what he thought.
McNamara, the then Secretary of Defense of the U.S. Government, had stated that the United States would emerge victorious in the Third World War. It would cost 160 million American lives and 90% of Europe's population. Missiles were on 15 to 30-second warning systems. The radar couldn't tell a goose from a cabinet minister. We felt we were living from moment to moment with the imminent prospect of the nuclear annihilation of the planet. And in that situation, to be saying to people, join our annual march, seemed completely out of keeping with the kind of danger we were describing.
No one thought that an earnest young American who spoke from a soapbox would become central to the British peace movement. But he did. Ralph Schoenemann seized his time. He took inspiration from, of all things, Italian history.
At that time, I was reading about the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, in 14th century Florence, as it happens, and they were forming councils of 100, involving people of distinction, and that was the genesis, I suppose you could say, of the Committee of 100.
So from Florence, 500 years before, came an idea to combat the most modern of weapons. A group of eminent people would disobey the law to attract attention to their demands. Ralph Schoenemann knew there were powerful figures in the peace movement who shared his impatience with its tactics. So his first contact was the most important, and for the movement, the most divisive. Bertrand Russell, white-haired philosopher, Nobel Prize winner, pacifist, and president of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Lord Russell's personal manifesto was already famous.
Whatever agreements of nuclear hydrogen bombs had been reached in time of peace, they would no longer be considered binding in time of war. Both sides would set to work to manufacture hydrogen bombs as soon as war broke out. For if one side manufactured the bombs and the other did not, the side that manufactured them would inevitably be victorious.
Those pencil drawings are ones I did in prison. That's one I did in a prison in Bangkok over our Southeast Asia project, and that's another one of the old Holloway prison when I was in there.
Pat Arrowsmith, with sketches on her walls of prisons she has known, sentenced to jail terms over the years for her protests in the anti-nuclear cause. She was one of the leading peace campaigners of her time on every Aldermaston march. CND, under its chairman, Canon Collins, wanted to go no further than marching. But Ralph Schoenemann was already writing letters, signed by Lord Russell, addressed to those at the head of the cultural renaissance of the time.
Was there a rift?
Oh, it was a hell of a bloody rift, yeah. I mean, there was a major row. I mean, there was Bertrand Russell, who was the president of CND and also the president of the Committee of 100. And as president of CND, totally at loggerheads with John Collins, who was, in fact, very pussyfoot about direct action and you know, and influenced CND not in those days to keep well clear of direct action and anything could smack of law-breaking.
Do you think the use of celebrities even then was... It was very knowing, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's blindingly obvious. It seems a perfectly sensible thing to do. And I think the Committee of 100 perhaps were able, because of the way the movement had built up, to be principled about it and to require more of than just sponsorship on a letterhead. I mean, it will add credibility today. It would be well-known pop stars. And no doubt if David Beckham were taking part in one of the actions, it would draw a whole lot more people than if he weren't there.
But the Committee of 100 felt celebrities were useful, but they had to take part too.
You can't compel anyone to take part in anything, but I mean, the people who decided that there should be a new organisation making more effort to get celebrities, you know, built on what had already been done to some extent and decided, you know, it was high time it took it a bit further, and these well-known people got down on their bums and did risk arrest.
It is my conviction, Bertrand Russell's letter went, that the effectiveness of our campaign is becoming dependent upon its endorsing a campaign of civil disobedience. A small group of workers sent the letters out. Some of the names on the envelopes, Vanessa Redgraves, for instance, remain familiar. It's in the nature of celebrity that the fame of others has faded.
Lord Boyd Orr and Sir Compton Mackenzie and Henry Moore and Benjamin Britten and Arnold Wesker and Robert Bolt and John Osborne and Sheila Delaney and Barbara Hepworth and Christopher Logue, John Arden. Quite a large spectrum of the writers and playwrights and artists of the day.
Whitehall, London. In February 1961, site of the Committee of 100's first and defining protest. Several thousand people, maybe 5,000, marched down from Trafalgar Square. At the head of the march, a banner read, Action for Life. Bertrand Russell, with all the authority of his 88 years, walked in front of it. Michael Randall, the Aldermaston campaigner, was next to him. Also there was a highly individual artist called Gustav Metzger, who had played a leading role in founding the committee. His work expressed his fears, auto-destructive art, he called it. There were nylon sheets painted with hydrochloric acid. They dissolved in a flash. The metaphor might have been obvious, but when nuclear war seemed imminent, there was no time for subtlety. Gustav Metzger and the other organisers had selected the most obvious target possible, the front doors of the Ministry of Defence.
We would sit down with Russell and Michael Randall at the front, and that went exactly according to plan.
You were sitting just behind him?
Very close, indeed, next to Herbert Reed, the art critic and historian.
There you were, sitting down. The police must have been taking close attention.
Yes, I would think so, but there was no interference. Once we'd sat down, the police didn't act. We felt, well, that's it. And that's how it ended, after a few hours.
The demonstration's almost like a meditation. Yes. You're sitting here quietly in front of the Ministry of Defence on Whitehall.
Yes, I think that's a very fair point of view, indeed. We were certainly meditating on the horrific issues which made us come together on that day. And also we were thinking ahead. We were thinking of the next demonstrations, how they might go.
Michael Randall was assigned to take a message to the door of the ministry.
It was a sort of a gesture like Martin Luther nailing his thesis on the cathedral. And we came up to the door and knocked on the door, and it was opened. And then we went to hammer this statement on the door. The official from inside said, no, you can't do that. This is a very precious door. You can't start hammering nails into it. And with that, the police seized the hammer and took it off me. So in true British compromise fashion, we stuck it up with sellotape. And it was accepted by the official from inside.
The statement was there on the door of the Ministry of Defence.
That's right, yes, and it was giving notice to the government that if they didn't get rid of these weapons of mass destruction, that there would be mass resistance to what they were doing.
To the delight of the organisers, the newsreel cameras were there. The tactics of the committee were working. As Bertrand Russell sat down, a reporter interviewed him.
For you to do this at your age, sir, is not a very sensible thing, one might think. How much further would you be prepared to go?
Oh, as far as is necessary. I mean, I suppose if I were in Russia, I should endure capital punishment. But in this country, they don't inflict it for that.
And you would go to jail?
Oh, yes, certainly.
No one was arrested that day. The authorities were embarrassed and confused. Lord Russell, after all, was an eminent citizen, an old man, grandson of a former Prime Minister. How was the government to respond? Professor Richard Taylor, author of several books on the peace movement.
I remember talking a long time ago now with Sir Alec Douglas Hume, as he was then, later Lord Hume, who at that time was Foreign Secretary, and he said he could never understand why they did not conduct their discussions and their pressure through orthodox channels. He said to me in an interview that if you had a group as high-powered intellectually as the original people who led both the committee and CND, presenting themselves to senior figures in Parliament and the civil service, nobody could have denied them a place at the table for discussion. But I remember his words, once you involve the riffraff, is how he put it, of people who come on street demonstrations and break the law, then the cause was lost. Nobody in politics was going to take you seriously.
On the opposition benches in Parliament, even among those who were raising questions about the danger of nuclear weapons, this new sort of demonstration didn't attract instant support. Dennis Healy, now Lord Healy, wondered what Bertrand Russell was up to.
He was not impressive as a strategic thinker at all, and I don't think he impressed the country very much, except part of the intelligentsia, simply because he was a very, very clever man.
he wasn't a strategic thinker in this regard.
No, not at all. Never showed any sign of it.
Where do you think his commitment came from?
Possibly a sense of guilt that he'd been in favour of using nuclear weapons against the Russians before they had them.
What about this strategy of pulling in these famous people, whether it was Bertrand Russell and so on, as the Committee of 100 did? Do you think now that was a sound kind of strategy? These days we're used to all sorts of celebrities being involved in campaigns.
Well, I think it certainly increased the publicity.
It comes down to whether it influences the policymakers or not, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, it influences the chattering classes, but the chattering classes don't make policy.
Whatever the doubts of the professional politicians, the demonstration was, in its own terms, an extraordinary success. And Bertrand Russell told reporters, "This is just a dress rehearsal." The Committee of 100 began laying plans for another, much bigger demonstration in the autumn. The week before it was due to take place, the authorities took action. They wanted no more embarrassment. 30 of the Committee of 100 were bound over to keep the peace. They refused. In court, the judge decided jail was the only option. Lord and Lady Russell were taken off to prison. The sentence was a week, in deference to Bertrand Russell's age. 28 others among them in the jail. Michael Randall, the activist, was among them. So was the writer Robert Bolt. Arnold Wesker, too.
I have only one image of Bertrand Russell that I can recall. And that is when we all went into Wormwood Scrubs and he was taunted by this shitty little warder who said something to the effect of, you know, "So you're a professor of philosophy, well, it won't do you much good in here." I mean, just the audacity of talking to a mind like that, in that way. And he had to strip. Like we all had to strip, and I thought it was very courageous. I mean, this was a very old man who was so disturbed by the threat of a nuclear holocaust that he put himself in the way of ridicule and this treatment, tawdry treatment by a prison officer.
Ernest Rodko was another campaigner in prison.
In prison with us in Drake Hall after we'd been in Brixton for a couple of days, there was Robert Bolt, the playwright, Christopher Lowe, Alex Comfort. We were aware of Siegel coming with his fleet of luxury cars to Drake Hall to try and get Robert Bolt out of prison on the basis that he had to continue with his script for Lawrence of Arabia, and he was holding up the work of 2,000 extras or something like that. I think it was slightly overplayed, but he did, Robert Bolt did actually sign and get out of Drake Hall, so he signed the binding over order.
There were wonderful moments, like Christopher Logue one day standing on a table in the canteen and banging on his tin plate and saying, "Gentlemen, can I have your attention?" Words to this effect. "Can I have your attention? My name is Christopher Logue. I'm a poet. I will be reading my poetry in the library tonight at 7 o'clock, and you will all be welcome." And he had a full house. Tremendous.
Trafalgar Square, September 1961. 15,000 people gathered for the biggest ever Ban the Bomb demonstration in London. 3,000 police were on hand, there to enforce an emergency order banning the meeting. The publicity in the papers, "Jailed the Star Sit-Downers," was the banner headline in the Daily Mirror, had done its job. A new set of the famous was there, recruited by the Committee of 100 to replace those in jail. George Melly was establishing his career as a jazz singer.
I went to the National Gallery, which is always a pleasure anyway, and there I saw Doris Lessing, much younger then, of course, and looking very glamorous, and she told me she was so in nerves, her nerves were so shot about the day, that she deliberately put on her best and sexiest underwear. I thought that was wonderful. Doris's underwear.
The celebrities were being rounded up in public, one of the hottest playwrights of her time among them.
Sheila Delaney, as a member of the Northern Proletariat, said, "I'm not letting them pick me up, you know. I'll get up. I know it's wrong. He meant to go limp, but I'm not doing it. I won't have them touch me," she said. And we were picked up very gently by the police, I thought, which was unexpected. As you know, one had all these bogey stories about them. And they took me over to their wagon and then hurled me with all their might into it when no one could see. And we had to get into little compartments with wire netting at the little wire netting openings, rather like, and I felt exactly like a battered chicken, which I told the rest of the imprisoned. And they all were amused at this idea, so I suggested we might imitate battered chickens. So all the way to the police station, I think it was Acton, we all went sort of, which was very unpopular with the constabulary. And then we were put in a cell and stayed there all night. Didn't sleep much. We played sort of games like charades and so on. Enjoyable, that bit.
The police arrested 1,300 people in Trafalgar Square. In court, there were token fines. George Melly had to pay £2. The magistrate said nothing warrants breaking the law. For the Committee of 100, it was a triumph, not least because the television cameras were there, live. The committee had created a drama with famous people as its leading players, and television loved it. This was one of the first demonstrations conscious of how it looked in the sitting rooms of the nation. Michael Randall watched on TV in prison.
It was very televisual, and ITN devoted, and actually printed in their programme beforehand, they devoted their afternoon session to live coverage of the sit-down. That is an indication of how new and interesting it was, because I'm afraid you could have as many sit-downs as you like, but that no television programme anymore is going to say, well, we'll set aside our afternoon schedule in order to be able to produce live coverage of this demonstration.
The newspapers were full of it too. The Committee of 100's strategy, organise a demonstration, get it banned, and then go ahead anyway, had worked. Gustav Metzger, the artist, had made some of his acid-on-nylon banners for the protest, but the committee, like his work, was to disintegrate.
The original workgroup had been put into prison, and when we came out, a younger set of people thought they wouldn't want to give up their position, and they began to make mistakes, partly because they were younger and less experienced than the people who had originally formed this committee.
Now the sun has come to earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death. Death comes in a blinding flash of hellish heat and leaves a smear of ash.
There were disagreements on tactics, on how to take these new techniques forward. Arnold Wesker.
I was tired of seeing my name around, and I thought, what protest I want to make now will be privately, thinking they might listen. Because you weren't making a spectacle, you weren't embarrassing them publicly, but privately they might listen. So who knows what impact one had.
And so the Committee of 100 declined. By 1963, there were just 30 of the original signatories left. Jail sentences became longer. But the legacy of the form of protest it originated, of that day the philosopher sat down, spread further than its originators could have imagined.
I don't think there's any doubt but that it was two bombs placed either in or under the ship that caused the ship to sink. The force of the explosions and the way the ship sank so quickly within 3 or 4 minutes leaves really no other alternative. There was nothing on board the ship that could have caused that violent an explosion.
July 1985, the Rainbow Warrior, a Greenpeace vessel on its way to protest against French nuclear tests, is sunk in harbour in Auckland, New Zealand. The voice is that of a Canadian environmentalist, Dr. Patrick Moore, one of the founders of Greenpeace International, based on the Rainbow Warrior. Dr. Moore says Greenpeace owes much to the Committee of 100 and to its president.
It's just too easy to have a kind of fluffiness around this sort of thing, where the person who is lending themselves to it and doing it just to promote themselves further and not really being personally involved in the campaign. So Bertrand Russell epitomized the total involvement of his own celebrity in the campaign against nuclear weapons. They were one and the same. Bertrand Russell as a philosopher and Bertrand Russell as a campaigner were one and the same. Whereas a lot of movie stars, when they lend themselves to a particular issue or campaign, you might wonder whether they really are that personally involved and whether they really know that much about the issue they're lending themselves to.
From Greenpeace to Live Aid, from Rhodes protests to campaigns against genetically modified crops, Bertrand Russell and the Committee of 100 provide an unlikely influence. Richard Taylor, the Leeds University professor who's written widely about the anti-nuclear movement.
It was the catalyst for a new form of political activity, not exactly replicated ever again, but the idea that people themselves could take political action in their own hands, that it wasn't necessary, or even it wasn't the only legitimate way of doing things, to work through established political parties, through electoral bodies, through trade unions and the orthodox methods of representation. It was quite legitimate, indeed it could be argued essential, to take to yourself the moral responsibility and therefore the political responsibility for demonstrating on what people felt were key political and moral questions of the time. And it showed for future generations, I think, that mounting effective, dramatic, well-publicised protest was possible just by ordinary people bringing themselves together, so that subsequent extra-parliamentary movements of all sorts drew a lot of inspiration, I think, a lot of political lessons from the way the Committee 100 operated.
The achievement of the Committee of 100 was to put the power of the media, together with the glamour of celebrity, in the service of a political cause. And so, as Ralph Schoenman suggests, the day the philosopher sat down was a day the protest movement has learned from ever since.
The Committee of 100 galvanized political opinion. It brought a heightened awareness of the extraordinary danger facing humankind. The dramatic demonstrations that we engaged in to do that seared the conscience of a generation. I feel that it vindicated itself by its results in allowing people to feel confident that they make a difference by inspiring people to continue that struggle and to pass that legacy on to the next generation.
I appeal as a human being to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, nothing lies before you but universal death.
From this moment on, When the Philosopher Sat Down was presented by Nigel Wrench. The producer was David Cook for All Out Productions.